Go ahead.
Okay, please be advised that an investment committee meeting of the Annuity and Pension Board has been scheduled for today, Thursday, June 24th, 2026, at 9 a.m. Can I get a roll call, please, June?
Yes, Mr. Allen?
Present.
Mr. Barmore?
Here.
Mr. Bell?
Here.
Mr. Christensen?
Here.
Mr. DeClean?
Here.
Ms. Ford?
Here.
Mr. Kovak?
Here.
Mr. Helling?
Here.
Quorum?
All right, thank you, Jan. We got a 8-item agenda today. We'll jump right in. Item agenda number one.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll just say something briefly, and then you can say the closed session language.
Sure.
If you don't mind. So agenda item one relates to Apogen Capital, one of the investment managers that manages some of the ERS's private equity allocation. All the ERS's private equity investments are made by committing money to limited partnership vehicles that are invested by managers such as Apogen Capital. Apogen requested the ERS's consent to amend the Apogen Private Equity Fund 11 LPA, which is a fund that the ERS has previously committed $40 million to. To deliberate or negotiate the ERS's investment in Apogen Private Equity Fund 11 LPA, we now need to request that the committee go into closed session for competitive or bargaining reasons. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. So item agenda one was to consider potentially approve requests from Apogen Capital regarding consent to amend Apogen Private Equity Fund 11 LPA. So please be advised that the investment committee may vote to convene in closed session on the following item one, as provided in section 19.851E, Wisconsin statutes, to deliberate or negotiate the purchasing of public properties, the investing of public funds, or conducting other specified public business whenever competitive or bargaining reasons require a closed session. The investment committee may then vote to reconvene in open session following the closed session. I will make the motion to go into closed. Do I have a second?
Bill, I'll second.
Thank you, Matt. And any...
I'll do a roll call. Mr. Allen?
Aye.
Mr. Barmore?
Aye.
Mr. Bell?
Aye.
Mr. Christensen?
Aye.
Mr. DeClean?
Aye.
Ms. Ford?
Aye.
Mr. Kovak?
Aye.
Mr. Helling?
Aye.
Quorum, and please say the time and I'll pause the recorder.
The time is 9:03.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Yes. Mr. Allen?
Aye.
Mr. Barmore?
Aye.
Mr. Bell?
Aye.
Mr. Christensen?
Aye.
Mr. DeClean?
Aye.
Ms. Ford?
Aye.
Mr. Kovak?
Aye.
Mr. Helling?
Aye.
Quorum?
The time is 9:20.
Thanks.
1 second, please.
Sure.
Go ahead.
All right, we're back in open session. It's 9:20. We've discussed, we're going to approve item agenda number one, the request for Apogen Capital regarding consent to amend Apogen Private Equity Fund 11 LPA. I will make that motion. Do I have a second?
This is Bill. I'll second.
Thank you, Bill. Any objections? Discussion? Okay, not hearing any. That motion passes. And item agenda number one is finished. On to item agenda number two, the Chief Investment Officer Report. David, take that over.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, Terry's going to help put something on the screen that I'll be referring to as we go through this. If you can go to that slide one first, perfect. So I just wanted to use this as an opportunity, a placeholder, to provide the committee with an update on the fund, how things are going. I'll be referencing slides, formats that you've seen before. So Here we have, we're estimating the fund value as of the end of the day yesterday to be about $6.72 billion. We've kind of layered in fund returns since Q1. We were about flat at the end of Q1. We had that 0.2% return, slightly ahead of the benchmark. April, markets had a strong rally. We participated strongly in that rally, getting 3.4%, trailing the benchmark a little bit. That rally continued in May. Our benchmark's up another 1.9% in May. Our fund, again, participating in this, it's an estimate. We're currently estimating about 1.6%. We still have a few things outstanding that we don't have estimates on that if we're fortunate enough, that might go slightly higher, but that's our best estimate with the information we have right now. And then it's just 3 days in June, we're showing that the fund slightly negative. Benchmark, about flat. We're penalizing ourselves a little bit on the benchmark because we're including a positive return from real estate for the month of June that we know we're going to get, and we haven't received any real estate reports yet there. So when you roll that all up, our best estimate of the fund return as of the end of the day yesterday is 5.2% net of fees, trailing the benchmark of 5.6%. If I were to kind of look at the attribution for that underperformance, the two things that stand out, number one, we have the real assets underweight impact that went on for the first quarter when we had to deal with the publicly traded diversified real assets manager transition early in that year, early this year. And then it also has private equity as a component of that. In Q1, the private equity benchmark was positive because stocks were up in Q4 and we're at a one quarter lag, and we hadn't reported any returns there either. So there's still a little bit of an impact there. We haven't even quite got all of our Q1 or our Q4 statements yet for private equity. We're getting most of them in though. So that's market value and return. There's two other slides I want to talk to and just give you another update on kind of the evolving public equity, new public equity structure implementation. I was at the board meeting last week where I think I referenced a slide within the informational that showed you the detail of a lot of the investment manager flows that were happening in May. I'm going to point to two different charts that kind of show you what's going on. Terry was able to help me get these two slides side by side. Thank you for doing that. On the left, what you have is what our asset allocation looked like on the day of our May investment committee meeting. I was able to pull this from our Friday mailing that we had sent just the day after that investment committee meeting. So the day we had the May investment committee meeting and approved the new public equity structure, you can see, really focus on that public equity overweight. We had a 38.1% allocation to public equity, that reflected a 2.1% overweight to public equity. On the far there, you also see in that same chart on the left, fixed income, where we had 34% of fixed income and a 2% overweight. Now, if you look at what's on the right, the side-by-side, this is what our estimate of our fund allocation is as of the end of the day yesterday. You can see that public equity is right at target now, and pretty much that's all gone into fixed income. The private equity barely changed, the private real estate barely changed, and the absolute return barely changed. And I can assure you that the public equity didn't go down to target because stocks went down. The good news is that when we sent out the Friday mailing, when we had that May investment committee meeting, our return was, I think, 4.3% year-to-date at the time, and I just told you that our current return year-to-date is 5.2%. So we were able to do all of this in a rising equity market. As I mentioned at the board meeting just last week, right, there's two ways to make progress implementing the public equity structure. You can take money from the overweight managers, or you can add money to the underweight managers. Since asset allocation is the biggest driver of returns, structure is an important second. All the work we did in May was really making progress on the new fixed public equity structure by getting working on getting the withdrawals closer to target for public equity. And the things you're going to see going forward are going to be smaller dollar amounts, but you'll see more of the flows in and out of managers to get the structure closer to the targets. So I thought that was interesting, and then I'll go, I have two other slides I was going to reference. The next slide, this is the detail essentially behind the two charts I just pointed, talked about. This was, this shows the fund value, again, as of the May Investment Committee meeting. Thank you, Terry. It was, again, $6.706 billion. You'll see that the public equity dollar figure was 2.556 billion dollars in public equity at the time, and our cash, I'll point to that, we had $65 million in cash. About $40 million of that was paid in benefits at the end of the June, so that number was going to go down to $25 million if we hadn't have done anything at all. Now I'll go to the last page. You'll see again the fund value is up even after paying $40 million in benefits. Our fund has done well enough to grow the fund after that to $6.721 billion. But you'll see the public equity, that number was like 2.5 something before, now it's 2.422 billion. And you'll see the cash number is 195 million. So basically by what we've done is getting the public equity to target, seeing the fixed income go up, we're not necessarily investing it with investment managers, we're putting it in cash, we're setting it aside to add a little money to real estate and pay benefit payments for the next, hopefully, few months. We're getting a nice yield on the cash, and we're, again, stocks have done so well that essentially we're just taking some gains from the stock market to set aside for known benefit payments that are coming up between now and the end of the year. So I think it's a good story overall. I mean, if the stock market continues to rally, we're at target. We're going to do what our intended risk and return profile in the spirit of it is. We'll participate if stocks continue to go up, but if stocks go down, you know, we're not going to be in a position where we have to sell investments to pay benefit payments. We'll have the cash on hand to ride out that volatility for those important and known benefit payments coming up. Those are my prepared remarks with the Chief Investment Officer update. If there's any questions, I'm happy to take them.
Thank you, David. Questions, comments from board members? Seems like an excellent report. Thank you, David.
Thanks. You're welcome.
Okay, on to item agenda number 3, approval of statement of investment policy update. You again, David?
Yeah, me again. So we have to update our statement of investment policy again, but these are all the important things that we're doing. So just apologize if it feels like you're seeing this at every meeting. We're just doing a lot at these meetings. Trying to keep this up to date. So I included a memo. I hope this was helpful to you. I also included a red line version of the pages that were ultimately impacted by the changes that you're being asked to consider today. So I'll just walk through the red line briefly, and you'll show you what you're being asked to consider approving, and then you can ask me any questions if you have any. So the first change you'll see is within the staff section of fiduciary duties. If you go to item J within staff duties, there's just a really small correction we need to make. The purpose of this section is to allow staff to approve ministerial contract amendments to private equity and real estate requests when we get them, and under very certain conditions. And one of the big conditions is that we have to take it to the board or investment committee if time allows it. Sometimes we'll only get a couple weeks notice on some of these, and it could be like the end of July, or it could be like right after a meeting, and it's not feasible to get it to to a meeting, on a meeting agenda. So this gives us the ability to act under certain conditions. So it's something that actually staff looks at anytime we get a request from a private equity and real estate manager. And I want to thank Eric for noticing this, because recently he was referencing this for a recent request and saw that term in the parentheses on that fourth bullet point just didn't make sense to us. And he pointed it to me and I agreed it didn't make sense. I did a little research and I found an old draft of this section from a number of years ago where these bullet points were kind of reordered in the draft. And it was referencing the first bullet point. And when it does that, it makes a lot more sense. So this is just cleanup, but that parentheses isn't supposed to say next bullet point. It's supposed to be referring to the first bullet point, the part about not giving us the ability to expand or increase the number of investments managers, for example, that we have. So that's the first one. The last two changes are all on this page right here. So these percentage red lines you see within the public equity section, I promise these all match exactly to what Callan presented last month to the public equity structure, that alternative to that you approved. We approved the public equity structure at the investment committee meeting last month and formally approved it at the board meeting last week. Now it's time to just make sure that the safe investment policy is up to date with what we just approved, and that's what we're doing. Again, the total public equity target is still 36%. You're just seeing international go up slightly, global equity go down slightly, and seeing a little come out of active large and into active mid-small, consistent with all the things we talked about within that public equity structure study we did last month. So the last thing is more of a discretionary thing. It's a request from me for you to consider doing. This was point two within the memo. It has to do with that footnote language, the footnote one language at the bottom. And it kind of, there's a little overlap to the conversation that some of the slides I was just pointing to in the Chief Investment Officer report when I was showing you some of those asset allocation pie charts and things like that. I'm requesting that the committee allow me to keep the fixed income maximum at 37% up until through March 31st of next year. Currently, the guidelines force me to get back below 35% by the end of this month. Our target of fixed income is 32%. Our typical maximum is 35%. Back in January, when we had to make the transition within the real assets allocation, while that was going on, we had a lot of cash going into our portfolio, which we could consider as part of the fixed income allocation. So at that time, we needed to increase that maximum up to 37% to allow us to do what we needed to do. And we did that. I think it makes a lot of sense to continue this for a couple of reasons. Number one, if you remember on that pie chart, where the two asset classes were underweight are absolute return, which is hedge funds, and private real estate. We've actually taken a number of steps to actually start getting money into real estate to address that underweight, but we're still very underweight that asset class. I think it's really important to stay disciplined and not to try to push too much money into real estate at one time, just to get us back within these guideline ranges. I think we need to maintain discipline to do that. In my opinion, we've maxed out with our current plans what we want to try to do. So it's going to take time, and we can't really address that, fix that part of it. The hedge fund piece, we're 1% underweight hedge funds. I don't think it's the right time to push that allocation closer to target either. I mean, there's a lot of our peers are raising their allocations to hedge funds at the time. A lot of the top managers in hedge funds, the people considered to be the top managers, have closed funds. They're not even accepting new capital. So there is a real risk if we're trying to give UBS and Goldman Sachs a little bit more money to address that underweight, that we're competing with a lot of our peers to get into not even necessarily what we would consider be what are managers with the best track records, for example. So there's a reason not to push that, and we can't do anything about private equity because it's illiquid. So my only two levers to pay benefits between now and the rest of the year are stocks and bonds. I mean, when we made this decision earlier this year, I don't think we envisioned the stock allocation to be up over 10% just 5 months into this year. To me, it makes a lot of sense to say thank you, stock market, for these amazing gains. Let's kind of trim that allocation, get us back to target, and use that cash for our known benefit payments that I kind of talked about a little bit too in the last agenda item. But I need a little help with the guidelines to really be able to do this right. If we don't change the guidelines, I'll be forced to start taking money from fixed income managers to pay benefit payments over the next few months. I think lastly, I'm trying to match up. I'm also matching up. You'll notice I'm now matching up the deadline or the kind of the dates for the to. I'm moving it to March 31st, which happens to be the same date we have the private real estate minimum. Kind of getting reverting back. It does help. Number one, I think it'll help me to. We do receive a lot of cash in January. We expect to receive a lot of cash in January from the city and the agencies. Part of kind of the actuarial contributions. It would be nice to have a little flexibility there within the guidelines if we're pushing our overweight at that time. So I think March 31st gives me the most flexibility for the rest of the year and for that January time period. And you know what? I envision at the March Investment Committee meeting, we're either going to say, all right, we're all within our new guidelines ranges. We can kind of let this disappear and revert back, or we'll have a conversation. Just you'll hear from me again, like you are today in March, and we'll talk about what a reasonable, prudent path forward is at that time. So those are the three items as part of this approval consideration. I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, David. Questions from board members or staff? Okay, not hearing any. This is a approval item agenda. Can I get a motion to approve the new investment policy?
Motion to approve. One more.
Thank
Alan, a second.
And thank you, Jerry, for the second. So the approval of the statement of the investment policy update passes.
Thank you.
Thank you. And on to item agenda number four, Dimensional Fund Advisors presentation. So we got two presentations, Dimensional and then Earnest Partners. So.
Excellent. Thank you all very much for having us. We appreciate the time. I want to do a quick check-in. We were planning, I think we spoke, Eric, to spend about 20 to 30 minutes depending on any questions that there might be from the committee. Does that seem like an appropriate amount of time to spend going over the portfolio and sharing any updates we might have?
Yes, perfect.
Okay, excellent. For those of you I have not met before, my name is Daniel Luque. I'm a regional director at Dimensional Fund Advisors. I service institutional investors and client relationships in Illinois and Wisconsin on behalf of DFA. Today I'm joined by two of my colleagues, Ross Orlando, who's a portfolio manager and vice president here at Dimensional, and we'll be going over the portfolios and the strategies that the city of Milwaukee is invested in. And I'm also joined by my colleague, Matt Daggett, who's a client relationship manager, and he works alongside me servicing institutional investors in the same territory. I'm going to go ahead and pass it off to Matt to kind of share a few Dimensional updates, but before he does, I just want to extend a deep gratitude to the City of Milwaukee. We have a long-standing relationship with your organization. We greatly appreciate, I don't believe Keith is on the call today, but it was great hosting him at our Institutional Investor Symposium here in Austin. So as always, we appreciate the partnership, and I'll go ahead and pass it off to Matt to share any Dimensional updates.
Great, thanks, Daniel. If we can go ahead and skip to slide 6. And while that's happening, yeah, thank you again to the committee for giving us the opportunity to present today. I will just mention, I know this is my first time meeting many of you, but I'm actually from Wisconsin, just down the road in Racine. So I'm excited to be here and be working on the relationship with you. I'm going to cover the firm updates as a whole before I pass it over to Ross Orlando to talk through the strategies that you're invested in more detail. So Q1 was a pretty busy quarter for Dimensional. While we ended the quarter just shy of $1 trillion in assets, we did cross $1 trillion during the quarter, kind of went back and forth a couple times with some of the market volatility, and are currently above $1 trillion, but that was certainly a big milestone for us. Around the same time, we celebrated our 45th anniversary as well, just after the end of Q1. So two pretty big milestones for the firm that I know we're all very proud of and excited about. We've also been busy, as you can tell, with a lot of research, and some of you may have heard about our ETF share class initiative that we've been leading. I know it's not super relevant for City of Milwaukee, but we did list the first active ETF share class in the industry, which was our US Microcap ETF, which I know we're very excited about. And since then, we've also listed our US Small Cap Growth ETF share class as well. And as you can see on the right-hand side of the slide, we have been keeping pretty busy on the research side. As you're all likely aware, we're very focused on research and a very research-oriented firm. So we're always happy to provide any of this research, or if you have any questions about research we might be working on, definitely feel free to reach out. Any questions on Dimensional as a firm or anything about the firm in general?
Any questions, board members, staff? Continue.
Okay, I will just touch briefly on slide 9, if you can skip ahead to that. Just demonstrating our track record. We have a high conviction in all the strategies that we launched, and this slide just really shows, that conviction, especially with the survival rate with, all the products that we launched 20 years ago. We have 100% survival rate compared to the rest of the industry. So very proud of the numbers on this chart. With that, I will turn it over to Ross to dive deeper into the strategies.
Yeah, thanks, Matt, and it's a pleasure to speak to the committee here today. So as Daniel alluded to earlier, I'm a portfolio manager within Dimensional, and I've been with the firm for quite a long time now, about 13 years or so. Certainly very involved in the details. So if you have any questions on any of the portfolios or the general implementation approach, certainly happy to help educate us and kind of walk through all of this together. So before getting into the specific portfolios that we'll be walking through, I thought it'd be helpful just to spend a couple of minutes as a refresher on, how does Dimensional think about the world? How do we intend to build our portfolios? So to help us go through that, we'll jump to slide 14. So we'll skip a little bit ahead here. And so, when we think about who Dimensional is, we tend to use empirical research to study capital markets, to help understand what drives returns. So we'll go ahead to slide 14, actually. So we tend to ask the question, well, what types of stocks tend to outperform over the long term, and which ones tend to outperform over the short term or underperform? And then we use this information within broadly diversified portfolios so that we can outperform benchmarks over the long term. And then we also focus relentlessly on adding value through implementation. So we're very much in the business of adding basis points wherever and however we can. And really, we've been excelling across all of these spaces for the better part of 45 years now. And as Matt was just illustrating, we tend to have that really strong track record of long-term outperformance. Now, I mentioned that word kind of implementation, and a key tenet of our approach to implementation is having consistent asset class exposure across all of our portfolios. And one of the ways that we go about accomplishing that is by doing a little bit of turnover every day of the year using a systematic, repeatable process. And it's that systematic process that's what allows us to consider DIM drivers across both the long-term, short-term, and intraday. And that's what this framework here on slide 14 is illustrating for us. So kind of walking through what we're seeing here, starting on the left-hand side, you have these long-term drivers, and Dimensional is very well known for some of these points here, where you have, for example, the size premium, which tells us that over the long-term, small and mid-caps tend to outperform large caps. You have also listed there the relative price premium, also known as the value premium, which tells us that value stocks tend to outperform growth over the long term. And then finally, you'll see listed there profitability, which tells us that over the long term, higher profitability stocks are expected to outperform lower profitability stocks. So you can kind of think of these three drivers as the main building blocks for asset allocation, which is going to be true across all of our equity strategies. And these signals, if you will, tend to be a bit slower moving in nature, a bit longer term. And so what that means is we can incorporate these drivers directly in portfolio design while still managing our strategies in a very low turnover way. And the good news is they also tend to complement each other well. So to the extent that you go through a time period where maybe one of these premiums is underperforming, there's a good chance that perhaps another premium will be outperforming to help offset that. So overall, what that means is we get better kind of long-term risk-adjusted returns, again, relative to a benchmark. Now, because we have that daily approach where we're doing a little bit of turnover every day, we're also able to consider some of these more short-term drivers. So we won't go through these in exquisite detail, but just to kind of provide an overview, you'll see some listed here on the order of the investment premium. There's also momentum and reversals, and then finally, securities lending. And really what these are is these are other signals that have been identified in the research that tell us something about expected returns, but the difference here being it's over a much shorter time horizon. And so what that means is when we go out to trade each day, you could think of it as us using these as a screen in our process that tells us maybe to hold off on trading a given name for that day, and then maybe we can go and reassess that name, say, 2 weeks or maybe 2 months from now. And then finally, intraday, very important for us. So what this means is we want to have flexibility when we go out to trade every day. We absolutely never want to be in a position where we have to trade a given stock. We want to make sure that we have that flexibility. And that's very important because some of the stocks that we're trying to go after, you want to make sure that you're not, for example, crossing spreads or pushing prices around, because having those heightened trading costs could ultimately eat away at the returns that you're trying to target within your portfolio. So this is something that we pay very close attention to in trying to trade as close to costless as possible. So kind of taking all of this together, we really spend a lot of time thinking about the details of implementation. We think this is very unique to our approach, and it's what, again, allows us to have some of that long-term outperformance. Any questions on implementation before we start walking through the specific portfolios here?
Questions? Quiet group this morning. You can keep going.
All right. We'll continue on to 17 here, and this will be the first of the three strategies that we'll be looking at today. The first one here being your separate account that is a U.S. large cap value mandate. And what we're looking at here is the portfolio design for your strategy. So you could think of this as a blueprint for how we actually manage the portfolio. So starting with the diagram on the left, you could think of this as representing the U.S. market. So we're going to be ranking stocks. On the left-hand side, you'll see it says size with large caps on top, small caps on bottom. And then across the top, you'll see it says relative price. So on the left, that's low relative price, which means your value securities. And then on the right, you have your high-priced or growth securities. So your strategy is a large cap value mandate. So from a size perspective, it's going to be investing in the largest 90% by market cap. That's what the horizontal line is illustrating. And then on the from a value perspective, we're really going to be investing in the most deep value securities. So you'll see on the bottom, it says those stocks with the lowest 30% based on price to book ratios. Important to note that that value cut, if you will, is going to be even deeper value than the Russell 1000 Value Index, which is the prospectus benchmark for the strategy. So what that means is when we are in time periods when value does well, we tend to do even better than the value benchmark, that Russell 1 Index. Now, within that large value space, we're then going to be doing some tilting within that space. So what we're going to then be doing is we're going to be overemphasizing within large value the names that look good across those factors that I mentioned. So we are going to be overweighting mid-caps, for example. We will be overweighting the deepest value names within that value space. And then we'll also be overweighting more profitable names. And so that's what that illustration kind of more in the middle of the slide is showing us. And then on the counterpart to that, we will be underweighting your mega cap names, your more growthier, perhaps less deep value names, and then your less profitable names as well. And so that weighting scheme is going to be relative to a market cap weight, which is very important. We want the amount that we own in a portfolio to be tied to its weight in the universe so that we don't take a lot of unnecessary tracking error. And then I mentioned that daily process earlier, so to give you a very practical example, you can imagine a name that was in that large value space and then starts to graduate out of it as it becomes a bit more of a growth name as it performs very well. What that would look like on the desk is we would perhaps look to trim a name like that and potentially eventually fully divest from it, and then use those proceeds to then buy a new name that's perhaps entered into that large value space. And so by having that daily process, what that means is we have that consistent exposure to that corner of the market, and it assures that we don't have any drift like you may see for a traditional index type approach. Now, a couple of other refinements that are worth highlighting. We do exclude REITs in this portfolio, and that's going to be true generally across all of our equity strategies. Now, for a large cap portfolio like yours, it's a, I'll call it a modest exclusion. It's about 4% of the universe. And then we also exclude what we call highly regulated utilities. That's going to be about 5% of the market. The reason we exclude those has to do with expected returns, and that utilities tend not to deliver the same magnitude of returns as other value type securities. Any questions on the portfolio design before we move on and look at some other traits of the strategy?
Any questions? I have a question. Can you just give like a couple examples, or like do you have an exact market cap, you know, whatever, $5 billion, and then it hits that, and that kicks it out of the large cap, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I looked, and as of yesterday, that demarcation is about $17 billion. So once a stock goes below that, it would no longer be in that kind of top 90%, and that number is going to fluctuate through time a little bit as well.
Okay, thanks. Mm-hmm. Any other questions? All right, keep going.
On 18, we'll look at some characteristics for your portfolio. As I mentioned, our strategies do tend to be quite highly diversified, so over 300 names in your portfolio. And then the latter three columns here are going to be indicative of some of the characteristics of this strategy that are relative to the benchmark. So when we look at the weighted average market cap, you'll see it's $240 billion relative to $370 billion for the Russell 1 value, and that's because we're tilting toward mid-caps within your portfolio. You'll also see aggregate price to book being lower than the index. That's exactly what we would expect because of that deeper value tilt. And then you'll see weighted average profitability just shy of the index. Primarily that's because as you go into the deeper value and more mid-cap space, you are picking up less profitable names. So by having a profitability tilt, we're getting back closer to the index than we otherwise would be. But overall, these characteristics are exactly what we would expect. And very importantly, this is going to be very consistent. So we're not doing a whole lot of tactical timing and trying to predict when, say, the value premium is going to be around. We want to have your portfolio consistently positioned to capture the premiums whenever they materialize. On sectors on 19, so the way to think about sectors across all of our strategies is that they are going to be more an output rather than an input. So what I mean by that is we're not waking up every day and trying to predict which sectors are going to do well or maybe not do well. Rather, we focus on that blueprint, that portfolio design, and then the sector weights are going to be an output of that. And so what you can see here is that our sector weights are listed with financials being the largest on the top, followed by healthcare, and then working our way down. The difference versus the Russell 1 are not going to be too extreme. So I think the largest on here is going to be energy, actually, which is an interesting kind of market story naturally from the past 3 to 6 months, where you do see a bit of an energy overweight. What's driving that overweight there above about 6%? Well, energy on average tends to be more mid-cap and deeper value than the overall market, so that leads to kind of a natural overweight there. And then with energy stocks performing so strongly in the first quarter, given what we saw with oil prices, that has led to a bit of an overweight there. But just as a general rule, you're not going to see extreme differences in our sector weights relative to the benchmark, notwithstanding some more unique stories like what we saw with energy. And that'll bring us to returns for this strategy on 20. You'll see we have listed both gross of fees and net of fee returns for your strategy, and then we also have the Russell 1000 value returns as well. So I'll start with the first quarter. You'll see there net of fees, your portfolio returned 4.5%. Relative to the Russell index, that's a 2.4% outperformance, so very strong outperformance. Really, a lot of things were working in your favor. The emphasis on higher profitability securities helped, meaning that there was a profitability premium for that first quarter. the emphasis on value securities helped. So value outperformed in that first quarter, and then emphasis on mid-caps also helped. So mid-caps outperformed large. So basically everything that we're doing in your portfolio worked very much in your favor. And a big byproduct of that, as I sort of mentioned a minute ago, was that energy overweight. Given energy stocks performed so strongly, that was a big benefactor or driver of that relative outperformance for the first quarter. Now, for that one-year time period, you'll see the numbers are going to be a bit bigger here. So net of fees for that one-year time period through March 31st, about 19.5%, with a 3.6% outperformance versus the Russell 1 value. So we're very proud to deliver that outperformance. The good news is the story is very easy. It's the same as the first quarter. High prof worked, value worked, and mid-caps worked. And again, once again, energy, and to a lesser extent, materials tended to drive some of that outperformance. So that's the overall story for the one-year time period. I actually just pulled returns so far through quarter two through 2 days ago, and we're seeing some modest outperformance in quarter two so far, about 20 basis points. So we're excited to see that outperformance continue. And then you can see some of the longer-term outperformance on the right, or performance rather. So at the five-year mark, we have about 90 basis points of outperformance. And then since inception, about flat, driven by some of the returns early on in the years when this account launched. Any questions on this strategy before we look at the latter two? All right, we'll move on to the International Small Cap Value portfolio next. We'll look at 22. You'll notice this picture probably looks pretty similar to the prior one. It's just going to be the inverse. So this is an International Small Cap Value portfolio. So it's going to be the complement where it's investing only in the small cap space instead. The definition we use here is slightly different outside the U.S. We use the 12.5% mark as opposed to 10% in the U.S., but overall a very similar type approach. And then from a value perspective, similarly, we're going to be investing in the cheapest stocks here. We define that as the lowest 35% of price-to-book ratios. Now, the prospectus benchmark for this strategy is the MSCI World XUSA Small Cap Value Index. It's always a mouthful. The index is going to have some similarities with some differences versus our portfolio. They tend to have a little bit of a higher size ceiling. They tend to go up to the 15% mark, but then they also don't go down into that microcap space nearly as far as we do. So we go all the way down to a floor of 50 million in market cap, and it's listed in the table on the far right, whereas the index tends to stop a little bit higher, something closer to, say, 300 to 400 million. And often what you will see is that can result in potentially more names, at least within that microcap space within our portfolio. Now, I mentioned before that value cut, similar to what we saw in your prior portfolio, that value cut is going to be deeper value than even that value benchmark. And so the portfolio tends to really benefit, really shine in periods of value outperforming. And then we also are going to have a profitability implementation as well. It's going to be slightly different in a small cap relative to a large cap strategy. And so what you'll see is that diagram in the bottom middle of the slide here. What we're doing there is we're taking all of those same small cap value securities and we're looking to sort of resort it, where now we're looking at profitability on that left axis. And so you'll see higher profitability names on top, lower profitability on bottom. And so what this is illustrating is across the entire small value space, we're going to exclude the least profitable names. And then as we get a little bit further from that very deep value corner, we're going to be a bit more selective on profitability. So that's kind of why you get that hockey stick shaped approach there, is really just illustrating some of the profitability refinements we're adding in this portfolio. Now, a few other refinements to mention, similar as before, we do exclude REITs. REITs are going to be a bit larger part of the market here. It's about 12%. And then we also, again, exclude highly regulated utilities. That's going to be about 3% of the market. Looking at characteristics on 23, all exactly with what we would expect here. We do list two indices just as a point of reference, the MSCI Small Value version as well as the MSCI Small Cap Neutral version. But in all cases, this is going to be what we would expect. Number of companies, again, very broadly diversified. Weighted average market cap, a bit higher than the index. A lot of that is coming from some of the kind of the momentum implementation, where we've actually held on to some European banks in Italy and Spain in particular that have done really well. But overall, what we would expect. Weighted average market, or sorry, aggregate price to book, just a tad lower than the index, and then weighted average profitability just a bit higher. So overall, positioned exactly where we would expect for this strategy. Sectors and countries on 24. Again, the same story applies for sectors where they're going to be an output more so than an input. So for example, when we see financials at the top, you'll see a bit of an overweight there, about 6% versus the index. Financials tend to be a bit more deep value in nature, so that's why you see a bit of an overweight there. And actually a similar story for both industrials and materials as well. Those are all sectors that tend to be a little bit more value within the international small value space. And then if we look all the way toward the bottom at REITs, you will see a bit of an underweight in REITs there, given that exclusion. So as I illustrated, about 12% underweight there. Now, countries are listed on the right. There are 22 developed market countries in total. The top 10 largest are listed here. And the way that we weight our countries is going to be following a market cap weighted approach. So all else equal, the larger a country in the international universe, the larger its weight in the strategy. We do that very intentionally so that we don't incur a lot of uncompensated tracking error. And what you will see is that our country weights tend to follow pretty closely with where the index is. So no two large differences here. So you'll see Japan is the largest country, followed by Canada, the UK, and then the rest of the countries following from there. Finally, we'll look at returns for this portfolio, and the takeaway here is the returns have been excellent, both on an absolute and a relative basis. So looking at the first quarter here, net of fees, the international small cap value portfolio returned 3%. Relative to the benchmark, that's about a 3.2% outperformance. By far, the primary driver of that is the focus on deep value. So value stocks in the international space in particular have had outstanding returns for much of the last 2 years or so. That's been a big storyline in international investing that very much continued through the first quarter. So that's going to be the primary driver of that outperformance for the first quarter, with the REIT exclusion also contributing, given that REITs actually underperformed by a slight amount in that first quarter. Looking at the one-year numbers, very large absolute returns. So 42% net of fees, that's going to be one of the largest 12-month returns for this portfolio ever, and it's gotten a lot of attention even in the media with how well this asset class has performed. And then you'll see relative to the benchmark, that's an 11.2% spread. So that's quite remarkable. Once again, that's being driven by the focus on those deep value names. As I mentioned, value stocks have been performing exceptionally well in international markets, so that's what drives a lot of that outperformance. And then to a lesser extent, the REIT exclusion also helped as well. So again, very proud to deliver that outperformance. And as you look out over the longer track record, 20 years and since inception, all the way back to 1995, you'll see the portfolio has delivered very strong relative outperformance over the long cycle as well. Anything else on this strategy before we look at the third and final portfolio for you?
Any questions? How come you guys don't deal with REITs at all? I don't know if I missed that or...
No, it's a good question. We don't have a strong preference one way or the other. A lot of it is feedback from our clients where they have often requested over the years that they want to customize their REIT exposure. Perhaps it could be for tax reasons or just general asset class performance reasons. So we actually manage a separate REIT strategy that only invests in REITs. And so a lot of our investors will actually pair a strategy like this one with a REIT-only portfolio.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right, we'll move on to conclude with the U.S. Small Cap Value Trust, so going back to the U.S. market. The design here is going to look very similar to the one we just went through. So once again, going back to that small cap value space. So here we're going back to that 10% cut before. And then again, we're looking at the lowest 35% based on price to book ratios. So overall, a similar theme as before, where relative to the Russell 2 Value Index, which is the prospectus benchmark, this portfolio will be even deeper value. So once again, we'll benefit in periods when value is doing well within small caps. The profitability implementation is the exact same as the prior portfolio, so we'll have a bit of a cut within that small value space. Oftentimes, this can be described as a way to, you know, not catch a falling knife. So as names are kind of entering our universe, we want to make sure we're not, you know, buying the worst names in that space. So you can kind of think of that profitability implementation as helping guard against that. And then the same exclusions will apply as before. So we have the REIT exclusion is about 10% of the market, and then the regulated utilities exclusion is about 5%. Characteristics, all what we would expect. In particular, we see the aggregate price to book and the profitability both notably diverging from the index. So the aggregate price to book being lower than the index from that more extreme value tilt, and then weighted average profitability being higher due to that higher profitability tilt. Now, I will say that this is one that does get a lot of attention internally and in the media as well. There's a lot of discussion and maybe even some consternation about some of the, you know, worst performing names within the U.S. small cap space. And so we feel that having that profitability overlay really helps protect us against some of those negative earnings companies. So that's why you see that really beneficial spread here versus the Russell 2 value. Looking at sectors here, once again, these are going to be an output more than an input. So similar theme as what we saw on the international space, where financials do tend to be a little bit deeper value. So you see about a 4% overweight in financials relative to the index. As a counterpoint, you'll see healthcare about the fifth row down, a modest underweight, about 4%. That's because healthcare companies within the U.S. at least tend to be a bit less profitable. So that profitability screen is going to be driving a bit of that underweight there. And then you'll see REITs toward the bottom about a 10% underweight there due to that REIT exclusion. All right, finally, we'll wrap up with returns for the U.S. Small Cap Value Trust. So for the first quarter, you'll see the portfolio returned 6.9%, delivering about 2% relative outperformance there. It was the emphasis on both higher profitability and deep value names that really contributed in that first quarter. And then we also saw both the REIT and the utility exclusion secondarily help as well. So really a lot of things working in the favor of the portfolio for the first quarter. When we look at the one-year time period, we see very strong absolute returns, so almost 27% returns for that one-year time period. A bit of underperformance versus the index, about 1.2%. In fact, this is the only time period across all of these time periods where there is a bit of underperformance. Now, what drove that underperformance? Well, in the most recent one-year time period, there has been a bit of a rally in some of the growth securities within the small value, within the small cap space, and so the emphasis on that deeper value actually detracted on a relative basis. And then similarly, we've very much been what you could call a junk rally, where profitability, we'll say less profitable names have been doing much better. So having that profitability screen actually detracted for that one-year time period. That's very much a short-term trend, and what we see over the long term as we look out to the right is we see very strong relative performance across all of these longer time periods. Any other questions on this portfolio or any of the other portfolios? Happy to answer anything.
Any questions? Not hearing anything. Anything else to add?
Nothing from our end. I think once again, I just want to express our gratitude for the longstanding relationship with the City of Milwaukee, and we look forward to continue working with you guys.
Yeah, thank you very much. Very impressive.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I'm sorry. I'll ask a question. Yes.
Sure. Go ahead, David.
Maybe I'll put this on slide 13. I know that, I know we talk a lot amongst our organization about, some of the style biases, small and large and value and growth. And it's over the long term, sometimes it can be hard over shorter term time periods, right? And sometimes shorter term can grow into, right, 5-year time periods, 10-year time periods to try to say, this time isn't different. Growth or large might shine during certain times, but, staying disciplined to small and value will hopefully reward the disciplined investors, right? What is your, whether it's research or your message when you have to, what are the things you focus on, I guess, when you're talking to whether it's clients about this subject, just to try to make sure they don't make the mistake of throwing the towel at the worst time, for example?
Yeah, it's a very good topic and a series of questions, and it's one that, folks like me and Daniel and Matt talk about all the time. And it's undoubtedly true that, especially within the U.S., we have seen an extended time period of growth securities and mega cap securities perform very strongly. A lot of that is driven by the so-called Mag 7, Magnificent 7 stocks, and it performed exceptionally well. But it does broaden out beyond that, but they do tend to be a bit of a focal point. A lot of their outperformance has been driven by what we could call unexpected profitability growth in the last 10 years, so their profitability has exceeded all market expectations. We've done a lot of research looking at that, and commensurate with that, we've seen their valuations increase quite dramatically. So if you look at their price to earnings ratios, for example, they've kind of grown into that. And so a natural question we have to ask, or anyone should really ask, is just because they've had that recent strong outperformance, would you expect that performance to continue? We would answer no. We tend to look over the long term, and once companies become that they tend to not continue to deliver that outperformance. And part of that's mathematical, because if they kept performing those returns, they would swallow the entire economy. So there is some kind of upper bound there in the first place. And then when we look outside the U.S., we've continued to see, for the most part, these factors perform very well. So there's certainly something a bit more unique within the U.S. space. So we kind of use that as a proof statement that these factors do tend to work, just perhaps not in the U.S. more recently. So kind of when we take all of those points holistically, we always want to just make sure, we're asking ourselves, is something different here? And when we go back to the theory and the very long-term data and what we see outside the U.S., that all points in the same direction, that look, these things do work over the long term, notwithstanding, again, the fact that we have undoubtedly seen probably a historical period of mega growth really outperforming. But we, again, to your intuition, to your point, we don't want to overreact and change the portfolio at the worst time.
I think I would add as well that, you know, we've seen something similar before. If you look at where the market was in March of 2000, value was underperforming growth in every standardized period. And then exactly 1 year later, March of 2001, value was actually outperforming growth in every standardized period. So that kind of goes to show you, we can't predict when these premiums are going to, materialize, as Ross mentioned earlier, but when they do, they happen very quickly and with great magnitude. So we want to make sure that we're positioned as long-term investors to capture that when they do materialize.
Thank you both. Yeah, it's one of the things. I mean, I think we all appreciate the conviction you have and the discipline, and you're basically from the very top, right, of your organization. It's mm-hmm. built into everything your organization does, and we know that when value, there's something to be said when we have, as a client, that we know that when that small factor, that value is going to overvalue, it's going to lead. We know you'll deliver, and because you stayed true to that discipline. So thanks for sharing your message though to your clients as well. Appreciate that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you all very much. We appreciate it.
One more question. Would you say the same thing with, you know, these new IPOs coming out with SpaceX and like just huge valuations? Like, I mean, there's talk about them getting right into the S&P. Like, does that mess with the market, you know, the market cap and all that, and the weights and the way you percentage all that?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's something we're looking at very closely. So to provide a bit of context, historically, the way that we have approached IPOs is through, like anything we do, through a research lens. And what the research indicates is that IPOs tend to underperform in the first 12 months after listing. A lot of that driven by some supply and demand dynamics, where there's some locked up shares that tend to become unlocked and come online on the market in that first 12 months. And then after that first 12 months, then you see it perform pretty similarly to other stocks. So in our process, we tend to exclude IPOs. Now, the important caveat with that is that we're kind of in uncharted territory, given that these names are so large. So it's possible we could tweak that approach, but we want to be very careful to not, you know, throw the baby out with the bathwater. We want to be very cognizant of what we're doing here. Now, the good news is that with these names, even though they, as a kind of the total size, you know, you hear numbers thrown out like $1.5 trillion for SpaceX, those are very large, but the amount of float, so the amount of shares that are publicly available, is going to be much lower. So in a kind of total market solution, you might see SpaceX only be, you know, 0.1% for now. Now, that's going to grow as those shares come online, but even if we were to exclude them like per our usual process, we won't be picking up a lot of tracking error. And then as that kind of 12-month cycle alleviates, then we'll potentially look to buy. So that's going to be kind of our general approach, but it is absolutely something we're looking at, just given that this is kind of a unique situation with these three names, with so SpaceX, OpenAI, and Anthropic.
Thank you. Any other questions? All right. Thanks again.
Thank you all very much.
See you all soon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Alrighty, so that wraps up item agenda number 4. Do we have Earnest Partners ready to go? Or do we maybe want to take 5 minutes? Use the bathroom? Why don't we do that? We'll take 5 minutes, come back at, what time is it?
10:15.
Come back at 10:20. And we'll go on with Earnest and Partners, the Earnest Partners presentation.
Katherine, are you doing the Earnest one? How about that? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
There we go.
Okay. All right, so everybody can hear me now?
Yep.
Yes.
All right, great. I think my speaker had switched since they couldn't hear me earlier. Well, first of all, good morning. Good to see everyone. My name is Pavan Malcolm. There's a couple bios of myself and Dinkar at the front of the book. But first of all, let me just say that it's a little over 20 years as of March of 06. So thank you for the long relationship. And you know, Earnest Partners has been a firm that's been employee-owned, and we've stayed employee-owned the entire time you've been with us and the entire time that we've been in existence. And we appreciate that loyalty over time. And today, myself and Dinkar, we're planning to just bring you a quick update on Earnest Partners, what's happening here, and then jump into the portfolio. We manage the mid-cap core portfolio for you. So if you think about the investable universe within equities, you kind of have the small cap and the large cap. And then within that large cap space, the smallest 800 names, that represents your mid cap space. And a lot of times that mid cap space will get overlooked because people really focus on the mega, which has obviously kind of dominated returns for a little while here. And so that's the area that we focus in on, and we'll jump in to that. Now, just as a quick reminder, one of the things that we've done from the very beginning is we've always wanted to take an approach where we find people that have been out in the world working in an industry. And then, for one reason or another, they've decided they wanted to pick stocks and use that knowledge as well as that experience to learn how to be an analyst, whether that's going back to business school or getting your charter or whatever the case may be, to pick stocks within that space. And then as a team, we evaluate these names and we pull it together to create the portfolio that we have on your behalf. So that's a little bit about how we do it. A little bit different than others, but what we want is we want diversity of perspective. We want diversity of industry experience. And we think that these different viewpoints and judgments and experiences, when they come together, ultimately that helps us uncover whether or not a company is being properly valued by the marketplace or not. Now, when we go out and we buy a name on your behalf, we own it, you know, on average for about 5 years. Average is always a bad metric to use because it can be misleading. So, you know, there are a lot of names that we go out and we buy, and then 12 months later, it comes to fruition and we sell it, or maybe we, you know, get it wrong and we sell it. And then there's some names that reinvent themselves and we end up holding it longer than 5 years. But on average, it's 5 years. And I say that because I think a lot of times when a lot of things are happening in the marketplace, people think that we're in making changes each and every day to the holdings in the portfolio. And that's not really the case. That's a little more of a trading perspective on things. What we're focused on is investing. And that means going out and understanding a business, and then figuring out what does the market not understand about that business, that when it does find out about that or does discover it, then the stock price will go and reflect it. And then once that happens, that's the ideal scenario in which we would exit a portfolio. So why don't we scroll down? There's a couple different pages in the book, but let's go on down to page 6. And I'm going to land here just for a second. And this is the mid-cap market, right? This is the benchmark. This is not your portfolio at this point in time. And what it shows you is it shows you on the left of the different economic sectors that are out there. And then it also shows you what was the return for the benchmark over the quarter-to-date period as of 3/31, as well as the trailing one-year period for the different economic sectors. And what you can see is that there's been a lot of disparity in terms of what's driven returns in the benchmark. You can see that energy has done particularly well, and information has done particularly well. And that makes sense given everything that's kind of happened in the world. If you think about the world and kind of the biggest drivers of what's happened here recently, it's been around AI, right? It's been about around, that revolution has been around software companies and a little more micro perspective as it relates to AI. And then it's also been about the conflict in the Middle East and the supply and demand for oil. And so those have been sectors where there's been a lot of volatility, but ultimately those are areas that have done particularly well, with information technology kind of leading the charge over the last 12 months. And then you can see some areas like consumer, as well as real estate and financials have been some of the laggards. And when we manage the portfolio, we're not trying to go out and get in front of certain sectors or be underweight certain sectors based on some type of forecast. But what we're doing is going out and we're identifying individual names, and then your portfolio is a result of finding those individual names. So now let's move on to page 8, and let me jump kind of straight into performance. And we updated performance through April 30th. Given when we kind of got you the presentation, wanted to get you as up to date as possible in the quarter. And you can see that performance has been strong here recently. Year to date, the portfolio is up about 12.7%, outpacing the benchmark, which is up about 8.7%. And then you can see on the 12-month basis is outperforming by about 750 basis points. And then on a three-year basis is behind, portfolio's up about 15.5 and the benchmark's up about 16.3. And just to explain that, if you look at the last 10 calendar years, there's only been 2 years where the portfolios has had relative underperformance. Underperformed by about 170 basis points in 2018, and then we underperformed in 2025. To the tune of about kind of 780 to 800 basis points. Those have been the only years where we've had relative underperformance. And there are going to be times when we have relative underperformance. And what we want to make sure is that when we have relative underperformance, we understand why we've underperformed. And in the case of 2025, as you know, a lot of names did particularly well, not because they were fundamentally doing things great, but because there was a lot of euphoria and a lot of excitement around AI and what was going to change and what was going to happen. And there was a lot of names that did well just raced around those stories as opposed to around earnings. And so we didn't chase some of those names. As you can see, in the past 12 months, the portfolio has made all that back up and has done it with less volatility and less risk. And then as you kind of move out to the 5-year and the 10-year, you can see very solid absolute returns over the last 10 years. The portfolio is up 13.9%, benchmark up about 11.6. So performance is something that we're always focused on, but at the same time, it comes from a very steady, disciplined process as opposed to moving around in the markets trying to chase things. Now, if you go to page 9, we put in here just a batting average that just shows you on a rolling 5-year basis, the portfolio has outperformed almost 80% of the time. And that's what we're really looking for. We're looking for that consistent outperformance over time while taking on less risk. And we want clients to look back on rolling, you know, periods and say, hey, they did the right thing on our behalf. And if you go to page 10, what this shows you is just an absolute return of 11.3%. And that was taken as of October 10th of 2025 through the end of the first quarter of 331. And you can see that the portfolio is up 11.3% and the benchmark was up 4.2%. Now, the interesting thing, the reason that we picked October 10th is because that was when things in the market in 2025 really started to change. There was all this kind of hype and excitement around AI and what was going to happen, and all of a sudden people started to see how much CapEx was being spent out there and started to realize that not every person that's or company that's spending money in the AI space is actually going to benefit in the form of earnings. And so people started to be a little more discerning about companies that were in that space, and you saw a pullback in a lot of different names. And we just highlighted it as, hey, that was a period of time where if you'd stay focused on fundamentals. Now, up until this point, up until the third quarter of 2025, if you'd actually looked at the benchmark, the Russell Midcap, names that had negative earnings, in other words, companies that weren't making money, were actually doing better than companies that had earnings. And that doesn't make sense. Now, if you extend that analysis out over longer periods of time, then companies that have earnings have done much better than companies that don't have earnings. And the point there is that we didn't chase in that point in time. We stayed true to the discipline, which is to go out and buy good companies that have earnings. And we have a high degree of confidence that those earnings are going to come to fruition over the next 12 to 15 to 24 months. And the last component is you're not paying a ridiculous price. You know, we saw a lot of names in the quarter that were trading at 50, 60 times earnings, and you know, historically going out and buying companies at those kind of multiples has not been a prudent way to deploy capital. And then I think I'll land on page 12. This kind of will summarize the performance, and we like to talk about percentages all the time in our industry, but at the end of the day, you pay benefits in real dollars, so this is kind of real dollars. You entrusted us in March of 06 with, '05, so it's 21 years, with about 161 million, or May of 05, 161 million. Over that period of time, the net withdrawals has been around 163 million. And so then the portfolio through performance has generated the 191 million, which is basically where you are today from an ending balance standpoint. Okay, let me switch gears, and I'd like to go to page 13. If you look at page 13, what this shows you is how the portfolio is positioned relative to the benchmark. These weightings are an outgrowth of a bottom-up process. We don't manage these from a top-down perspective, but more or less just the result of the process. Keep in mind there is some wiggle room here because this is just an interpretation of how Russell decides to put a name. They might say, hey, this is an information technology name, and so they put it into that sector. And a lot of times you could say, hey, well, really that's more of a financial name, and there could be made some arguments. So we don't get too caught up on the sector allocations, but you can see, generally speaking, where we have relative overweights and underweights. You can see that information technology and industrials, we have an overweight. We're underweight utilities, consumer staples, and communication services. And I thought it might be helpful just to take a couple minutes and talk about a couple names in the portfolio in terms of why we own them and how they've done. And so I'll let Dinkar talk a little bit about the names, and then obviously if there's any questions, feel free to ask questions.
Yeah, thanks, Beth. And happy to talk about a few of the names and just broadly areas we're finding opportunity. I tend to focus more of my time on information technology, so I'll pick a couple of names from that sector. But essentially what we're doing is we're trying to look for companies that are exposed to some inflection that is not being priced by the market at the time that we make the investment. And as that inflection comes to fruition, as it starts to filter into company earnings, those companies and the stocks and those for those companies tend to do well over time. A good example is a company like Entegris. Entegris is a very very niche company within the chip manufacturing ecosystem. And what Entegris does is it provides these very, very sophisticated filtration system and ultra-pure materials that are used in the manufacture of the most advanced chips. And very, very technically sophisticated solutions for purification. And we're talking about levels of purification that are in the parts per quadrillion. And just to put that into perspective, if you had all the volume of water flowing over the Niagara Falls in a day, a single drop of contaminant, and that would be parts per quadrillion. So once you get to those levels of technical sophistication, which is necessary to make the most advanced chips, you're talking about a very, very rarefied space in terms of the competitive dynamic. Entegris is by far the leader in that space. And as you looked at the evolution of AI, which is largely being driven by what's called Moore's Law, which is making the basic building blocks of chips smaller and smaller until they're almost at the atomic dimensions, one of the problems that really crops up that these manufacturers have to solve is contamination at these very at these atomic levels. And of course, as last year we saw kind of a broad swath of AI names take off, the kind of obvious participants in AI, like the NVIDIAs and the Broadcoms, the names that you hear about in the Wall Street Journal, but a number of names behind the scenes that were enabling this AI revolution were really not being talked about at all. Integrus was one of those names. You have other names in the portfolio, like a Form Factor, that are really kind of driving this evolution or enabling this evolution behind the scenes, so we're not being talked about it, so we're trading at fairly cheap valuations. And last year, these stocks didn't really do particularly well. In fact, they may have underperformed the market as they were being overlooked. And this year, as the street's starting to realize that, hey, you know, AI requires solutions from these players, they started to do very, very well, and we've started to see that reflected in the outperformance numbers that we're showing on the prior slides. Again, as Pavan mentioned last year, the market, there's a lot of hype in the market. The market moved away from fundamentals. Just to illustrate that, I mean, if you were to look at the quantum computing names, right, the top five quantum computing names by market cap over a year ago was about $2 billion. Fast forward to October of last year, and the market cap of those combined companies was $60 billion. So it's a 30-fold increase in market cap for those companies with no earnings. These were companies that are hemorrhaging cash by their own admission, wouldn't have a viable product well into the 2030s. Those are the companies that we stayed away from. It's really very hard to make a fundamental case for good returns at those valuations. And then that resulted in relative underperformance broadly at the index level, but showed up as unprofitable companies doing better than profitable companies. But of course, I mean, you can only stray so far from fundamentals. Fundamentals tend to be like gravity with the investing world. And as people have returned to disciplined investing, to really paying for what they get, some of those high flyers have sold off, and some of the names, the higher quality companies that we own in our portfolio have done very well. And over time, over 5-10 years, you see that as consistent outperformance for the portfolio. But I'll pause there and turn it back to you, Pat. I'm happy to kind of discuss names from the portfolio if there's interest.
Okay, thank you, Dinkar. Maybe we'll land on the last page, which is page 14. And, you know, at the end of the day, what we want to buy for you are really good businesses that are misunderstood for one reason or another. And this is kind of a summary of what your portfolio looks like relative to the benchmark. The first thing is it's a PEG ratio, so the price to earnings ratio divided by the growth of those earnings. And so you want a lower number, all else being equal. And you can see that the PEG ratio for the portfolio is at 4.2, lower than that of the benchmark at 5.6. So you want to go out and buy earnings less per dollar of, in terms of how much you pay per dollar of earnings. You want to pay less, and then yet those earnings, you want them to grow faster, and that ratio is beneficial for the portfolio. And that's kind of a forward-looking metric, right, because we're looking at forward earnings. Now, if you look back historically and looked at what's been the return on equity that the companies have actually made and generated, you can see that your portfolio, which is on the left, generated 17, whereas the return on equity in the benchmark is 14.6. So having generated a higher return on equity. Now, return on equity is one of those metrics that it can be manipulated based on leverage, right? If you have a bunch of leverage, then that can make your return on equity look a little better in an up market. And so you can see that when you look at the leverage in the portfolio, less risk, the portfolios you own have been able to generate a higher return on equity with actually less leverage. And over time, that's helping manage the broader risk within the portfolio. So with that, I will pause there. Happy to answer any questions about the process, the market, names within the market, or any other questions that you might have.
Questions from board members or staff?
I'll ask a question, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Go ahead, David.
Maybe on slide 19, if we can point there, it's, if you want to comment on this, either Patman or Dinkar.
Yeah.
I know that this is kind of a unique feature, and I mean, I couldn't help also, I guess, when you showed slides 9, when you were showing your rolling periods and how I think it looks like every period where the benchmark's been maybe down, up 6 or 7%, or even to negative, like you've always outperformed, and all any underperforming rolling period has been kind of the in really strong markets. So, maybe if you wouldn't mind commenting on, maybe relating it to the market environment we're in right now, where some people are saying that markets, whether they're frothy or the unprofitable companies have led the way, or maybe from a historical perspective, markets are on the more expensive side across the market capitalization spectrum. How do you rely on this and maybe expectations for us? If the market were to pull back, like, what would be realistic expectations you would tell a client like us with your emphasis on downside deviation? So.
Yeah, happy to answer that. I mean, it's a great point and something that we spend a lot of time and effort on. First of all, this right here represents kind of our approach to risk. We have kind of two broad, approaches to risk. The first is spend the time to do the work, go out, meet with these companies, these management teams, kick the tires, understand the businesses. And if you do that, you're going to avoid some risky situations. And then secondly, use data and statistics to help you kind of manage that risk. And what we're really focused on is managing the downside risk. And what this page basically shows you is that you have a benchmark return here in the middle. You see with the arrow pointing down. For illustrative purposes, let's say that the benchmark return represents 10%. Then what we've done is we've established a minimal acceptable return in the portfolio, and that's where the little square is to the left of the benchmark return, and that represents 4% below the benchmark. So again, in this example, that little square would represent 6%. And what we want to represent to our clients is that 80% of the time, the portfolio is going to meet or exceed that minimal acceptable return. So we construct the portfolio in a way that will meet that over time. Now, in our industry, there's no free lunches, so you've got to take on some risk, right? And that's the 4%. So we know there's going to be some markets where we do have relative underperformance. And as you pointed out, David, that there are, if you look at our history, that when we've tended to have some relative underperformance, it hasn't been when you're kind of single digit land or when you're in negative return land. It's been when the market's gotten, has run, right? And you have kind of double digit type returns. And that would make sense, right? Because the markets, they tend to overreact on both extremes, right? When things are good, it tends to overreact. When things are bad, it tends to overreact. And, if you were to relate that to where we are today, what I would tell you is people have been very excited about AI, and we're excited about AI. There's a lot going on, and Dinkar had mentioned, a couple of the names that are being affected by just the adoption of AI. Sometimes people are trying to find out who's going to be the absolute winner, right, the absolute winner or loser. We've bought names that are going to benefit just from the broader adoption of AI, and we feel very confident that's going to happen. Who knows exactly how that's going to play out, right? There's a lot of different scenarios out there. But what has happened is we call it the Jetson trade, these futuristic trades, and Dinkar alluded to it in the quantum computing. Like, quantum computing is something that, it's going to be around at some point in time, but we don't see any earnings in our investment horizon. So when you look out, I mean, even the CEO, the founder and CEO of NVIDIA, when he was talking about quantum computing, he put it out 10 years, right? People were saying, oh, it's only 3-4 years out. And he came out and said, I don't know why everybody's excited. It's like 10 years out. And so when you look at those companies, Dinkar talked about how much they increased in capitalization. The reality is zero of them had earnings, and only one of them had revenue, and that revenue was tied to consulting relationship, things they were doing on the consulting side. It wasn't even tied to quantum. So the point is that quantum is going to be important at some point in time, and it's a technology that people are putting money into, But if you're not getting a return on it right now, it's really hard to value it. And so those are the type of things that we want to avoid. And so when we talk about this Jetson trade, it's certain types of, or certain industries and certain companies within industries that are kind of futuristic. They're so far out that there's no earnings associated with it. So same could be said for, you know, nuclear modular reactors. I mean, what's the panacea for AI? It's the availability of power. You have to have power to generate or to run all these data centers. And if you were able to take a nuclear, you know, reactor, it's the same thing that you'd find in the bottom of a Navy sub, well, then that would be the solution to everything because it could just run off of that. The problem is they don't exist right now. It's like it's not even out there. And so companies tied to that, yes, they're going to help sometime in the future, but if they don't have any earnings associated with them and not in the near future, that's not something we're going to invest in. So the difference, coming back to your original question, is that there are companies out there that might be relevant 5-7 years from now in terms of making earnings, but what we've tried to do is find companies that are tied to the adoption of AI that are actually generating earnings today and buy into those and avoid those companies that are just being sold on kind of a story. And I think by doing that, you're going to benefit, you know, over time. It's not going to be quite as volatile. And when people do get very concerned about these companies that are trading at 70 times earnings and maybe they sell them off really quickly, the companies that you own are going to have an earnings base that's going to keep you from that volatility. And when the markets do pull back, historically, we have tended to outperform because of our approach and because of the risk metrics that we put in place.
Thank you.
Yeah. Any other
questions? Not hearing any. Just want to thank you guys both for your time. Very good presentation, and look forward to working with you in the future.
Sounds great. Great to see everyone. Have a good week, and thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, that wraps up item agenda number 5, the Earnest Partners presentation. Before we go back into closed session, we're just going to jump quick to item agenda number 8, the informational. Just to read at your leisure, the Callon First Quarter 2026 Performance Report was included in the packet. And we can jump back to item 8. And then we'll do 6 and 7 in closed session. You want to read your spiel, David?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Agenda items 6 and 7 have to do with contracts with investment-related service providers that the ERS works with. To deliberate or negotiate these two respective contracts, we now need to request that the committee go into closed session for competitive or bargaining reasons. Thank you.
Alrighty, so please be advised that the investment committee may vote to convene in closed session on the following items 6 and 7 as provided in section 19.851E, Wisconsin statutes, to deliberate or negotiate the purchasing of public properties, the investing of public funds, or conducting other specified public business, whenever competitive or bargaining reasons require a closed session. The investment committee may then vote to reconvene in open session following the closed session. So I will make a motion to go into closed session.
Mr. Chair, before we proceed to the vote, I know there was some discussion about adjourning from closed session. Is there still an appetite to do that?
I'm okay with that. If everyone is fine with that, and that's, we're okay legally.
Yep. Yeah, we're all covered on that front, so I just wanted to note it for the benefit of anybody listening so they don't hang on the line for nothing, depending on how long this conversation lasts. So sorry for interrupting, Mr. Chair. Please proceed.
Nope, sounds good. So yeah, so this will be it for the public session. We're going to close our meeting in closed session. So I made that motion. Do I have a second to go into closed?
This is Bill. I'll second.
Thank you, Bill. Can I get a roll call, Jim?
Yes, Mr. Allen?
Aye.
Mr. Barmore? Mr. Bell?
Aye.
Mr. Christensen?
Aye.
Mr. DeClean?
Aye.
Ms. Ford?
Aye.
Mr. Colbeck? Mr. Colbeck? Not present. And Mr. Helling?
Aye.
Quorum and the time, please. I'll pause the recording.
Time is 10:52 a.m.
Thank you.